You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, and the power of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
Thank God for backup cameras.
Mike Mejia is helping his coworker back up a Tesla Model Y within inches of a parked car.
Just a little bit more. A little bit more.
That car is in a garage in the downtown Arts District, and it's blocking access to an electric vehicle charging station. And that station is out of order, and Mejia is here to diagnose the problem.
And up to reach and connect.
Mejia works for an LA-based startup that offers on-demand support for charging stations. In other words, they address a problem electric vehicle drivers already know all too well, says CEO Camille Terry.
We fix broken charging stations because they break. And most of the issues, you know, aren't electrical. Stations are huge computers that are complex. And we fix them.
With all that money pouring into electric vehicles, Terry and her business partner are bringing big changes to big tech. Today, KCRW's Megan Jamerson brings you this profile of two local women making the green revolution happen.
You might have noticed electric vehicles are hot right now. Starting in 2035, all new cars sold in California have to be zero emission. And the Biden administration is investing billions in charging infrastructure and subsidies for EVs. So here in Los Angeles, entrepreneurs like Camille Terry are responding. Terry used to work for a company that made software for charging stations. She says up to 40% of stations were broken at any given time.
But I also don't think that we really had a good understanding of what we were building.
When stations broke, electricians were hired. But most of the time, the problem wasn't electrical. It was vandalism and software glitches.
They're smart devices that, like, when's the last time software worked without a glitch, right?
So she developed a business idea to address the problem. Then she approached Yvette Ellis. Ellis had a background in workforce training, and she says she was excited for Terry.
I was super hyped for her because she's a Black woman in tech doing it. So I was like, you're brilliant. You go, girl. And then she said, do you want to be a co-founder? I said, no, girl. I just want to root you on, right?
Soon, Ellis changed her mind and they started the company Charger Help in early 2020. They are based in the Arts District at the Los Angeles Clean Tech Incubator. Building an inclusive and supportive company culture was always part of their business plan. They made sure to offer on-the-job training for their repair techs. This was important because they were already seeing barriers to the industry. For example, Ellis says it was common to see job descriptions requiring 10 years' experience when the technology had only been around for maybe four.
This was a who-you-know industry. And it was about to bust, and now we see with the infrastructure bill, right? Like, this is the biggest change in transportation since the horse and buggy. So, no, we can't make the same mistakes and not allow everybody opportunity to get a piece of the pie.
And Charger Help really is offering employees a piece of the pie. They get stock options. Also, they are guaranteed 40 hours a week, at least $30 an hour, and they receive benefits. Mike Mejia, the tech making that repair at the beginning of this story, is very happy with this package. In fact, he used the word love to describe his feelings for his job. He says the support he receives here is in stark contrast to the pressures he was under as an automotive tech.
It feels like I'm part of a big family, you know? Because we're all just focused on different areas of the company where we all want to improve ourselves, you know?
His coworker, Stephen Hargett, who was driving the car we are in, says he left a good job as a building manager to work with Charger Help in order to make an impact around climate change. Doing that on a team with economic, racial, and gender diversity really excites him.
I think particularly because I have two kids, it's like I could keep managing a building or I can kind of like do something that my kid, if I ever go to a career day, will be proud of me to do.
Camille Terry says while they aren't building their brand around the fact that it was founded by two Black women in tech, one from South Central and the other from Compton, their lived experiences influenced what they created.
I would never want my brothers to feel unsafe. I would never want my mother to have a job that she couldn't grow and like get decent wage off of, right? I would never want my father to not have, not have retirement money. So if I would never want these things for the people that I care about, and I know these things have been done to them where they haven't had that, like why, like I have to build a business differently. And so I think like that's the greatest addition to society, and it's so needed today because we've done such a horrible job of building quality companies that properly support individuals.
And now their hard work and growth around the country is being widely recognized. Terry is calling it their harvest season. They just raised $4.5 million in bridge funding. That's a fancy way for saying investors saw things were going well and they forked over a second round of cash. Terry says this is a big deal because there was a lot of capital for Black entrepreneurs after the murder of George Floyd in May 2020. Over 2 years later, she says the momentum from the social movement is long gone. And
a lot of, you know, Black founders, female founders typically don't get that second round of funding.
And then Yvette Ellis received another sign they were on their way.
I got an email from the White House.
Charger Help was invited by President Biden to celebrate the passage of the Inflation Reduction Act.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Hello, everyone back there.
Ellis was one of around 2,000 people on the White House lawn and didn't get to shake the president's hand, but she says it was still thrilling.
It is very exciting to be counted among the change makers that are really, really making strides in this industry to be invited there.
And as they cement themselves as leaders in the industry, Ellis says she thinks of their parents. Hers both struggled with respiratory illnesses and have since died. Terry's mother died of breast cancer.
And so for me, like mass EV adoption and greenhouse gas emissions, like all of these things are so real to us, right? It's so real that we have to figure this stuff out.
Because as Ellis says, they are their parents' wildest dreams. For KCRW, I'm Megan Jamerson.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, you won't have much use for an EV charger if you don't drive an electric vehicle. So let's talk a bit about the EVs themselves. For years, there have been credits aimed at helping you buy an electric car, so you too can search for a working charging station in Los Angeles. But there are new incentives and regulations coming down the pike, passed by the Congress and signed by President Joe Biden, that will change the kinds of credits you can get, which cars actually apply, and updates actually the charging infrastructure to boot. There's a lot of confusion around it. So we've got Max Gennis here to help. Max is an economist and CEO of a nonprofit called Policy Engine that's based up in Oxnard. Max, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's talk about what is in effect right now. As of this day, on this Wednesday in Los Angeles, if I were to go and buy an electric vehicle, what kind of incentives would I have?
You'd have the same incentives you had before the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, with one change that went into effect immediately upon passage. And that's that the car has to be assembled in North America, final assembly. And that leaves 23 vehicles that are meeting that requirement as of this morning.
23. So fewer cars that meet that requirement as of right now, but still the $7,500 tax credit that you get with the electric vehicle when you buy it.
Yep. And okay. Actually, that top line number, 7,500, doesn't change under the new law either.
It doesn't change. All right. So now other things will go into effect when the Inflation Reduction Act was signed, right? The incentives did change in what's going to happen either later this year or going into next year. Talk a little bit about those changes.
Yeah, so later this year, the IRS will issue guidance on the elements of the bill that have to do with critical minerals and battery components. So this is basically largely to ensure that those parts of the car are not made in China. There's some other details, but essentially that's the goal there. So that'll happen sometime later this year. And on January 1st is really when the some other major pieces come into play as well. So in particular, they will replace the per manufacturer cap. So right now you can't actually get a Tesla vehicle or a GM vehicle. And that's because those sold more than 200,000 vehicles, which was the limit under the prior law. So you can get Teslas and GMs subject to the other requirements, but the MSRP is limited. So you can only get the credit if the MSRP is 80,000 or less for trucks, vans, and SUVs, or 55,000 for other vehicles. There's also an income cap that takes effect in January, and that's 150,000 per year for singles, 300,000 for joint filers.
All right, so after the first of the year, there will be a cap. You can't buy anything over $80,000. So that would exclude a lot of Teslas, I would imagine, right? After the first
of the
year. That's right. Yeah. Tell me what the difference, Max, and this is what I have a confusion about, is what's the difference between a subsidy and a tax credit? If you say a $7,500 tax credit, do they take $7,500 off of the MSRP or at the dealer, or do I file that on my taxes the following year?
Historically, it's been the tax credit, so the second of those two. So you have to file it on your taxes, and that's still how it will be until 2024. So the bill gives the option for you to transfer that tax credit to the dealer starting 2024, at which point they could basically just reduce the price for you and you don't have to deal with it on your taxes.
Okay. So, but for right now and into next year, you still have to file your taxes and apply it there. That's how you get the break.
That's right.
Okay. So, all right, the subsidies kick in 2023, as we mentioned. Do you think it might actually be better for some folks to try to buy an electric car now before those new subsidies kick in before the end of the year? I mean, what's the better value for you?
Yeah, if you're likely to be ineligible in the new year and you're interested in one of those 23 vehicles, that number might change by the end of the year. But yeah, it could be a good time to buy. So if your income is high or you're looking to buy one of those, for example, some of those more expensive electric vehicles, you would be able to get the credit for now and not in the new year.
What about people, Max, who are unable to claim $7,500 on their taxes? Maybe they don't pay that much in tax, or, you know, lower income people who may or may not be able to afford an electric car. How does it affect them?
I think one thing that's not being reported too much is it's what's called a non-refundable tax credit, which means it can't reduce your liability below zero. So basically that means it's not going to benefit the lowest income purchasers of electric vehicles.
So it won't benefit the lowest income.
Yeah. So if you suppose your income's maybe $10,000, $20,000, you're barely paying any income tax, maybe $1,000 income tax. So the $7,500 tax credit will only be worth $1,000 to you.
It doesn't take you negative. I see. It doesn't. Yes. I see what you're saying. I know electric vehicles, Max, are at a premium right now, but dealers, I mean, if you go and try and buy a car, we see that dealers are charging anywhere from, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 above the sticker price. Is it even worth looking right now, given the kind of situation we're in? Supply chain issues, chip issues, things like that.
Yeah, some of those will resolve naturally. Some of them might be based on the fact that you've got this credit, and so sort of supply and demand, you're going to get more demand. But I think there's a lot of other incentives as well that could make it valuable, and these will persist into the future too. So there's the tax credit for electric vehicle chargers. California has its own state incentive program, which is also a tax credit, and some local areas, including LA, actually have extra charger subsidies and used electric vehicle subsidies as well.
Talk a little bit about some of these other subsidies and credits that you can get through the state of California, through LA County or the city of LA.
Yeah, so California has what's called the Clean Vehicle Rebate Project, and these are income-tested programs more so than the federal one. So to be eligible, you have to have income below $135,000 if you're single, or $200,000 if you're married. And they are smaller, so they're between $1,000 and $7,000, and that depends on your income and also the vehicle. At a local level, so the LA DWP actually has a tax credit for chargers and for used electric vehicles.
Obviously, it's still very confusing, a bit of a mess, but in the end, do you think all this will work to get larger numbers of people into electric vehicles? That's the goal, right?
Yeah, it's a big impact. You know, you're looking at between state, federal, local, upwards of $10,000, maybe $15,000 if you get all the credits and you buy the charger. And, you know, compare that also, some people will get solar panels, which makes the whole package more attractive. I think that really is enough money to move the needle for a lot of folks.
Max Guinness, an economist and public policy entrepreneur. Max, thanks for walking us through all this. It's a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, straight ahead, big art that mirrors LA life. That's coming up after this short break. Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Los Angeles for decades has been known as a city of murals, large swaths of art on walls that pay homage, memorialize, celebrate, and even castigate a slew of people and events. And few places exemplify this artistic license like East LA, a neighborhood that, like the rest of the Southland, has been changing, but where large-scale murals are still a fact of life. Well, a new exhibit from the artist and native Angeleno, Patrick Martinez, looks at East L.A. and his life there. And here to tell us more is our art insider, Lindsay Preston-Zappas, editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hey, Lindsay.
Hi, Steve.
So this show is called Promised Land. It's currently up at the Charlie James Gallery in Chinatown. And before we go deep into Patrick Martinez's life, tell me about his artwork. They look like murals, but maybe not murals. I mean, they're really vibrant.
Yeah.
You know, you look, there's a lot of magenta, a lot of purples in there. What's going on there? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think his work is so unique because he's literally bringing this language of the street and of kind of facades of buildings and things that you see just driving around LA into the space of the gallery. So he's really doing this like literal one-to-one mirroring of that language. He paints on stucco. So he's using stucco, like we build our buildings with stucco, right? So he already is kind of using that facade. And then he creates layers of paintings that he'll paint over, and then he removes layers using a pressure washer. So it, very much like our city walls and city streets, there's sort of this building and taking away that happens. And his paintings might be of Mayan or Aztec murals that really call back to kind of a history, but then also sunsets, graffiti marks, advertisements for bouncy castles. So it's really a range of information. But I think what is so interesting about his work is that he starts to kind of build this history within each of his works that really, again, mirrors our city streets and how information and murals are constantly getting covered and painted over and coming back. And so his work almost feels like an excavation of that history.
Do you think that's why he chose what he chose, you know, with so much texture, is that he's really trying to put a slice of life out there of LA, right? That he's so interested in this place that he wants to exemplify it in art.
For sure. He grew up in Pasadena in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, it describes it as a very different place at that time. You know, it was very diverse. There was a lot of gang culture. There was graffiti culture, lowriders. And, you know, when he was 12, the Rodney King riots happened. And he talks about that really making an impact on him, where he really saw firsthand Black and brown violence kind of within the backdrop of our city. So I think his work has a lot to do with representation, right? Like kind of telling these stories of people of color that don't always get told in our city. And he also calls himself an observer of the city, which I think is so interesting. And he also uses the word landscape to talk about his paintings, which, you know, often we think of landscapes as being like a mountainside or like a pretty field. But like, you know, to think about these murals as landscapes, I think is so significant because it implies sort of a prolonged looking and a faithful representation of what's around. So I think it's very much in honor of the city and its residents for sure.
I know you spoke to him last year on your Carla podcast about like how planned it was for him to do these pieces because he did want to put that sort of slice of life out there, right?
100%. I mean, I think he's someone, like I said, he's an observer. So he's looking, always looking and kind of taking that in. So he was a guest on my podcast and, you know, he definitely will see things that just spark his interest and a wall that's like just right with a banner covering a neon sign, you know, these little moments. He does a lot of like pictures as he's going around his day. He also does a lot of drawing and sketches and some planning, but he also leaves room for unexpected things to happen in the painting.
Like sometimes a piece of material or something I see in the city will activate what my next painting is about. That's sometimes worked out 50, 60%. In my head and on with notes and stuff. And then sometimes it's like 30% and I'm just going for it and figuring it out.
Yeah. So I think a lot of that, you know, he plans some of it, he gets inspiration for some of it, but then a lot is happening on the piece too. And so I think that speaks to these moments in the paintings that feel looser where information sort of like bleeds together and kind of creates these unexpected moments.
I understand that Patrick recently became a father and is going through changes personally. I mean, do you see that show up in Promised Land?
It's interesting, right? I mean, I think so much of Patrick's work, I think of this idea of record keeping, like I talked about, kind of showing our city's past, also kind of alluding to its future, right? One example he gives is like he used to always use neon signage and now he's starting to use LED signs because the technology is changing. So things like this, kind of like tracking the changing world. But I think part of that is also like thinking about what's looming over our city, which is gentrification, that like these facades that he's paintings might not be there. You know, and I think the title of the show, Promised Land, he's definitely thinking about, okay, like who is the city promised to? Who was it promised to? Who will it be promised to in the future? And I think part of that is definitely thinking about his daughter and kind of the world that he is building for her and what we'll leave to the next generation.
Well, the show will be up for several more weeks through October 22nd at the Charlie James Gallery in Chinatown. Lindsay Preston-Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Carla. Lindsay, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Sue Margulies, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Holly Adams, Christian Bordahl, I'll help put this evening's episode together. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Of course, thinking of our friends in Florida this evening. Have yourself a good night.